Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Last week, I had the pleasure of speaking with 17-year-old Lizette Carter. She was recently crowned Miss Beaver Creek. On today's program, you'll hear part of that conversation and find out why the girl who says she's not a pageant-type girl entered a pageant contest. We'll also talk with Dr. Sylvia Esser-Gleason with Project Congo and hear about the important work they're doing. And in our weekly series road trip, we'll head to the northwest corner of the state with producer Greg Tye. Up first, some of the world's most beloved artists are noted for having had a creative rebirth later in life. The phenomenon has been written about and studied by art historians. Community Voices producer Alexis Larson introduces us to one local woman who tapped into her creative energy later in life and found that it has become a fountain of youth and yielded an extraordinary body of work and a new lease on life.
Winnie Fiedler came to Dayton nearly 70 years ago after being reunited with her husband Otto, who had returned from the war. She was a young bride with an Ivy League degree and the start of a promising career. She was the complete package: young, smart, talented, beautiful. To many, it seemed like she had it all, but there was a giant missing piece that ached to be filled.
We came to Dayton. We eventually found an apartment. After he'd been home for a while, walking down Main Street with him, looking in the windows, and all of a sudden, I started to cry. What is the matter with me? I should be happy as a lark. My husband is home. I have no worries. He's making money. What's wrong with me? Well, I know now what was wrong with me. Here I was. I had experience at the beginning of a career, and I was doing nothing. Nobody knew me. Nobody valued what I was or what I had been. I wasn't a strong woman. I was defeated by the circumstances. And I think that happened to a lot of women at that time.
The sadness she speaks of is a stark contrast to the charming, happy intellectual I spent several magical evenings earlier this year getting to know. Like all things in life, there was no direct path to this moment. Each night, weather cooperating, Fiedler takes a trip outside to enjoy the sunset. This spring night is no exception. The colors of the sky stretch out in bright bands as far as the eye can see.
Oh, I just love to do this in the evening when the sun goes down. First of all, this is a great time for photography. You've got a wonderful light. It's called the sweet hour. I like to go over here and sit down under this tree, which is a great oak. Look at it. Don't you want to hug it? Here, let's sit here.
Seeing the world through Fiedler's eyes this night, everything seems brighter, richer, and more alive.
Look at how that orange is just so strong. It glows against the black outlines of the trees.
At age 60, after the death of her husband Otto, Fiedler began to study and experiment with photography. She became so passionate, she took on the monumental and expensive task of setting up her own darkroom so she could focus on her new love full-time. Photography was the gateway to her affair with art that has nurtured her for the last 30 years.
I took a number of courses at the Ohio Institute of Photography. I was 60 when I took the first course at OIP. Took a lot of pictures, spent a lot of time in the darkroom, had a great time. I didn't become an artist until long after I started to make things that I thought looked pretty good.
Her natural curiosity and time in the classroom had sparked a fire. She quickly went to work setting up a fully functioning darkroom in her house and experimenting with what was possible. Looking for a challenge, she became inspired by the composite prints of photographer Jerry Yulsman, whose body of work was driven by the idea that an image created in the darkroom needn't be defined by a single negative.
It's a technique that requires care, precision. Each image has to be properly exposed so it will look as though it was the same single image from the camera. If you're careful, about the 10th time you do that, it'll look good.
With the advent of digital photography, Fiedler felt it was time to take on some new challenges. And she did just that, delving into three-dimensional textile art with a vengeance. To some, it may seem an unexpected change from the contemporary photography pieces she had been working on. Still, she sees many similarities between the two.
I didn't start with the idea that this is what I'm going to accomplish. It grows. That's the way I've always worked with art. I start with an idea. I start with a thing. In my quilts, I often start with a fabric. I love that stuff. Ooh, it's beautiful. It's sensual. It's sweet. It's pretty. Or it's rough and textured, and let me do something with that.
Following the same creative process that drove her photography, the textile pieces that she has produced are loose and vibrant, with an unpredictable energy that surprises and delights the viewer. It's a far cry from the controlled and calibrated quilting that often comes to mind. Fiedler's art expresses as much youthful, happy energy as she does. The question on my mind as we sit outside to savor the visual treat of light turning to dark is, what new medium or projects will this prolific artist take on next? It's a difficult question to answer.
You're more alive than a lot of 30-year-olds, you know? I mean, you've got it going on.
Well, it makes me think I want to hang around a little bit longer. It won't be much longer. There's something about being clearly in the last stage of a long life where some things don't matter the way they used to. And you live in the present because you don't know the future. And you've had such a long past, it's all jumbled. You have to have a reason to point at some particular thing. So you kind of live for the moment, as we're doing this at this moment right now.
For most dedicated artists, the act of creating is like breathing. It's the oxygen they require to stay healthy. At 90 years old, Dayton resident Winnie Fiedler is living proof of the power that lies in discovering and nurturing the artist that exists in each of us. There may not be a fountain of youth, but the joy, discovery, and satisfaction Fiedler has continued to harness from pushing the boundaries of what's possible with her art may just be the next best thing. This is Alexis Larson, living in the moment and reporting for WYSO's Community Voices Project.
This year's Community Voices trainees will present their work at a special screenless screening at the Film Dayton Festival today. It's from noon to 1:30 p.m. at the Black Box Improv Theater. Ticket information at filmdayton.com. For more information about WYSO's Community Voices Project, visit wyso.org and sign up for our mailing list. Join us next Tuesday and Sunday for more new work from WYSO's latest Community Voices producers. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WYSO Weekend. In this week's road trip, we explore American military history in the northwest corner of the state. Fort Meigs, a 10-acre war of 1812 battlefield in Perrysburg. Producer Greg Ty is your guide.
Fort Meigs is the largest wooden fort ever built in North America. And it's easy to see why they built it here. Marching up this 40-foot bluff from the Maumee River seems like suicide for an enemy army, especially if the ground is wet like it is today. That's probably what the fort's builder, Eleazar Wood, saw as well. And it's a good thing he did. Rick Finch, director of Fort Meigs.
When we declare war on Great Britain in June of 1812, things go terribly wrong. And it's just a series of defeat after defeat after defeat. By August of 1812, we have lost Forts Detroit, Fort Mackinac, and Fort Dearborn, which is now Chicago, Illinois.
To make matters worse, the British wiped out part of General William Henry Harrison's army at the River Raisin in Michigan. The Americans desperately needed a victory, so Harrison assembled his troops at the Maumee Rapids. Larry Nelson is adjunct professor of history at Heidelberg University.
On February 1st, Harrison begins to build Fort Meigs, a large and imposing facility that is intended as a supply depot in which he can accumulate the men and supplies necessary for him to recoup his army and then carry the war to Canada.
Most of the construction was supervised by a Corps of Engineer captain by the name of Eleazar Wood. a bright young West Point graduate who becomes the chief engineer officer to Harrison's army.
Dr. David Curtis Skaggs is professor of history emeritus from Bowling Green State University.
They're building it in the winter, and the Indians are not going to attack in the winter because they're holed up in their villages, and the British are not going to attack in the winter.
These guys are doing this completely by hand in the wintertime. A fort that takes 3,000 logs just to make up the walls, it's completed in 3 months. The fort on the riverside has a 40-foot high bluff that comes up off of the river, and then around to the east, it had a ravine system as well. So it's a great natural defensive position.
The British attacked Fort Meigs twice, in May and July of 1813, but the U.S. garrison held. The American victories continued, and Harrison's troops went on to invade Canada and destroy the retreating British army. The Battle of the Thames on October 8, 1813, essentially ended the fighting in the Old Northwest. Eleazar Wood was an architect of the American success. He designed Fort Meigs, supervised improvements to Fort Stevenson in Fremont, Ohio, and then commanded the artillery at the Battle of the Thames in Canada. Later, Wood was reassigned to Fort Erie near Buffalo.
He is killed in the War of 1812 at a sortie that he leads out of Fort Erie.
When he's killed in 1814, he becomes the first West Point graduate to die in combat.
Perrysburg, Ohio is located in Wood County, named in his honor. There was also a star-shaped fortification in New York Harbor that was named Fort Wood as well. We know that better as the base for the Statue of Liberty. From Fort Meigs in Perrysburg, Ohio, I'm Greg Tye.
You can download the new Ohio Guide tours at seeohiofirst.org. The new Ohio Guide is produced by the Ohio Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Lizette Carter is a 17-year-old senior at Beaver Creek High School. She is a public relations officer for the National Honor Society, and she's involved in varsity track, volleyball, cheerleading, and karate. On display in her home are several shelves filled with ribbons and trophies that testify to the enthusiasm and talent she brings to each of these things. Lizette is also not afraid to try new things. She was recently crowned Miss Beaver Creek, and when we sat down in her living room recently, she told me that she doesn't consider herself a pageant girl, but she did have specific reasons for entering the contest.
I don't know. I've always been a natural girl. No makeup, no extensions, just natural girl. I'm comfortable being myself. And I wanted to show other girls that that is good. Like, that is beauty, being yourself and being confident in who you are as a person. So.
And how did you come about that awareness? From your upbringing?
Yes. I've always been taught to accept yourself the way you are. I mean, no one else will unless you do. So especially growing up in Beaver Creek, it's like you have to really know yourself in order to become involved in the community. And so it makes life a lot easier.
And tell me a little bit about the process. You've told us why. And so I want to know a little bit about the process, your application, submission, and then take us through you getting the title.
Okay. Well, you get an application from the high school, or I guess they offer them to like the STEM high schools, like the Career Center or different things like that. And so you have to fill it out and you have to send in a picture and you have to have references and your whole, basically like a resume about you. And then from there, you're chosen for like a second step to let you know that you are actually in the competition. And then the first night was just getting to know the girls, and it was an interview, like a professional interview with the judges, and then getting a whole bunch of nice goodies and sweets from everybody. And then the next day was the actual competition where you had a talent portion, like an opening number, an onstage question, and presenting an evening gown. So it was basically like a real like pageant. Think Miss America without the bikini portion. So it was basically like a real pageant. The nerves were there. The energy was there. It was really great. And oh gosh, I was so nervous. I really was. When it came time for the crowning, I couldn't stop moving. And when I won, I was definitely shocked, but I was happy. And the first thing I did was I looked to my family to see what they were, because I know they were so proud. So I just wanted to see their reaction first. So.
How many of your family members were there?
Oh, gosh. We had a good four rows of people. So that's about 30 people, yeah. Outside family, friends, everybody was there. My grandmother, yes, she was a big person that came.
And what did you do for the talent portion?
I actually did a mixed dance. Like, my grandmother, she was my inspiration for it. She loves to see me dance, and she always wants me to show it to the world. And so, but she's kind of old school, so she likes tap dancing. So I dedicated it to her, and I did like a tap dance, but then I switched into what I'm more into, which is hip hop. So I did kind of a mixture combination.
You mentioned how nervous you were, and something you also mentioned in the newspaper article was that you wanted to try and be brave and to show courage this year. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about why.
Well, it was basically going outside of my comfort zone. And yes, I was brave in doing that. But at the same time, there's always natural nerves there. But yes, I wanted to show that being brave also comes with nerves. But then again, there's success that comes with it, too.
So are you going to apply that courage into other areas this year and beyond?
Oh, most definitely. It definitely gave me like a little like confidence booster. Like, you can try new things. In college, I'm not afraid to apply anywhere. I'm going to try for Harvard, for Yale. I guess the possibilities are endless.
And so you're just beginning that process of college applications?
Yes. I'm just trying to apply everywhere that has what I want within the college.
And what do you want?
a medical program, because I plan on being an anesthesiologist, and lots of like diversity activities and also sports.
So let's talk a little bit about things you like and things that make up being Lizette. What kind of music do you like?
Oh, gosh. I love a lot of music. Actually, old school music is, I guess, being with close to my grandparents, I just love old school music, like the old blues and Motown, and I guess now 2000 is old school music too. But I like basically anything you can dance to, really, because I'm not a big fan of classical, but anything that you can dance to, that you can, you know, nod your head to, I like the music.
Lizette, for young people, there are a lot of things to deal with in the world today. It's tough to be yourself. It's tough to have courage to try the things that you want to do. Can you tell me a little bit about your thoughts on that?
I think the easiest way to cope with the world is to turn off the news. There are so many negative images portrayed of the youth, and that sometimes that scares people. Sometimes that turns people off from the world. I think that you should most definitely research all the good that's being done in the world and then try to be a part of it yourself. Like, be involved in your community. See what's up in your community. If, you know, you don't like the way your school system goes, like for us, we lost our buses, then look into that. See how you can get into a city meeting. And me personally, I try to also stay close to God and to pray and ask God about things. You need to believe in something, whether it's God or not, believe in something to help you cope with everything that's going on with your life. There's plenty of ways to deal with the world, I guess, but you just have to know how to find them.
Who are your idols? Who are people you look up to?
Most definitely Oprah. She is like the complete story. She moved up from a small little town in Mississippi, so she's very influential to me, and she has grown to inspire so many people, and she helps and gives back to others also, even with her success. And also my mommy. Yes, my mom. She's so strong and supportive. To deal with me is not an easy job, so she's I respect her a lot for that. And my grandmother, they're both just such strong individuals. Like, they believe in God, and they put that into me, and they make sure I have good morals, and they're just such loving people, and I really want to grow up and be just like them.
Lizette, thanks for speaking with us today, and do you have a message for our listeners?
Oh, goodness. Okay, sounds very cliche, but be yourself. Like, don't be afraid to try things. Be daring, and success is not what people view, but it's what you think success is. If you think success is going for something and being different from the crowd, then go for it. To me, my success this year was going out and becoming Miss Beaver Creek 2012 without having fear about it and just embracing myself with the whole thing.
Lizette, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Miss Beaver Creek, 17-year-old Lizette Carter, thanks to her and her mom, Yolanda, for welcoming me into their home, and the best of luck to Lizette as she enters her senior year at Beaver Creek High School. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is Why So Weekend. Thanks for joining us. Project Congo is a grassroots organization here in Dayton that sends food, medical equipment, supplies, and medications to refugee populations and victims of crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Dr. Sylvia Esser-Gleason founded the organization. I spoke with her about the work she's doing, and as she explains, much of the conflict in the Congo has to do with mineral rights.
The Eastern Congo has been engulfed in almost continual warfare for the last 20 years, with over 6 million dead. That makes it the second deadliest conflict since World War II. And so much of it is civilian deaths, because what it ends up being, militia and rebel-type armies that fight to control an area with the ultimate goal of controlling the mineral wealth in the area. In the Eastern Congo, the mineral they're fighting over is coltan. That's a acronym taken from columbite and tantalum. It's a white powder, and it's used to make electronic circuit boards. So basically, it's in everybody's pocket because it's in your cell phone, it's in your laptops, it's in your computers, it's in your iPads. Congo has it, and the world wants it, and because of that, people have to die.
So let's talk about Project Congo and a little bit about its history. When was it formed?
Formed it in year 2008, so it's a relatively new organization. I had been traveling to Africa before that as part of Bridge to Rwanda, a local grassroots organization here in Dayton that was helping an orphanage in Rwanda. And almost by fluke, I got the opportunity to go to the Congo in year 2008. Literally what happened is I arrived my first morning in the Congo with my daughter. We had medical equipment. We were planning to head into the interior of Rwanda to the orphanage. And there was a knock at my door, and it was a priest from Goma, which is a border city in the Congo. And he said, I hear you're a doctor. I hear you have medical supplies. Come with me to the Congo. And I was taken a little bit aback. I had been reading a little bit about the Congo situation. A big part of me wanted to go, but I've got my 18-year-old daughter there with me. So it's a little dicey. Should I cross into this area that's known as the epicenter of rape in the world? I realized there was a huge refugee crisis and a war going on. Should I really cross over there with my daughter? So in the long run, we left it up to my daughter, and we said, should we go? And she didn't miss a heartbeat. She said, let's go. And that very afternoon, we were on a bus with two priests heading for Goma in the Congo. And in Goma, which at that time had almost 2 million refugees living around it.
Was that overwhelming to you?
Yeah, it was. As a doctor, I felt almost there was so little I could do. I ended up at a Salesian center called Don Bosco Ngangi. They were helping the refugees. They had a small medical center. I was almost aghast to see that they didn't have things as simple as oxygen, dependable electricity, enough food. I left the Congo just kind of overwhelmed with what I had seen, and I determined that I was going to try to help in some small way. And initially, I didn't think about forming an NGO like Project Congo. I thought, I'm just going to do something little. And I think I was so struck by the lack of oxygen that I thought, I'll work a couple extra shifts. I'll buy some oxygen concentrators. I'll send them back to Ngangi. Well, little ideas have a tendency to grow, and before I knew it, I was collecting all kinds of medical supplies and went ahead and formed the NGO, and we've just grown from there.
And what were you able to do in the immediate circumstances, your first trip there?
I helped the doctors at Ngangi, but I stress that everything I do is help the people who are on the ground over there. For me to go for a few weeks at a time, I'm not making a big difference in doing that. But I met doctors, I met nurses that were Congolese over there with a heart to do something for their people, and my work is to help them in their work.
Let's talk a little bit about them, their attitudes and their experiences and their dedication.
Incredibly dedicated. The doctors I meet over there, it's almost sometimes surprising that these doctors and nurses can get up and go to work every day because they're so overwhelmed when they get there. But I find their skills very good, especially for what they do. A doctor over there trains for 6 years, but when he comes out, he is fully surgically trained. They do cesarean sections. They do appendectomies, peritonitis. They set fractures. Some of them even were doing external fixation of fractures. Now, some of them have never seen a CAT scan machine. I ran into some that had never interpreted x-rays. But for the limited resources they're working with, they're very, very capable. and very adapted to their work conditions.
As you said, Project Congo is a new organization. Let's talk a little bit about where the NGO is in its current form.
We're still a very local, a very grassroots organization. We have a board of directors. We have local volunteers that have helped in such things as collecting medical equipment. We've been supporting a girls' soccer team over there because women are so abused over there. There's a high rape incidence. That on one of my trips, I met a girls' soccer team that was formed largely out of orphaned girls and girls who had been raped or abused. We decided to help the local soccer team. There's been a big outreach here in Dayton area where they've collected cleats, they've collected equipment, they've paid high school tuition for some of these girls. I have other volunteers that are actually working with refugees from Congo, Rwanda, and Burundi here in the Dayton area to help them kind of restart a life. And interestingly, what we're doing with them is community gardening, but also some integration type work. So we're working on a lot of different levels for a small organization.
And of course, it goes beyond the medical services that you're doing.
Well, I feel like you can't minister in medical services if people don't have basic needs, the ability to feed themselves, basically some psychological help, but mostly to be self-determined. So we've tried to establish some vocational training for women, with some agricultural type projects for women. And also I always feel that education is important. So partnerships where families pay for high school and elementary school tuition for children.
And have you seen any metrics or getting any feedback on the work that you're doing?
It's been positive. I mean, we're a small drop in the bucket because we're a small organization, but I travel back each year. I see the medical equipment I send over being used. We've had already a few children graduate high school that we've supported. We've seen our pig project that we do with the women over there just grow and grow.
And what is that?
We call it the Pig Cooperative. And we started with a breeding program for pigs, and local women join into the cooperative. They're given a piglet, and when it's of breeding age, they breed it. And then they bring back a piglet from each litter to keep the cooperative growing. And that's grown from a dozen pigs to several hundred.
Explain how that benefits the community there.
Well, the obvious thing would be as a food source, but maybe a less tangible is when you have a pig, you have something. And suddenly you're a little bit wealthier. You have almost a bargaining position because you have a material possession. So in a lot of cases, we haven't seen the pig so much used for food as to build a business for the women. And something as simple as actually owning something, it can be a launching board to a small business.
And so what are your biggest challenges right now?
Financially, more donations, but that's every NGO would tell you that. It's also a problem as we get in medical equipment, it's always hard to ship over there. We have done one large 40-foot container. A lot of it's sent by post. Matter of fact, I was just at the post office on the way over here shipping things. A lot of it we hand carry on our trips because each member of the trip can carry 100 to 150 pounds of equipment each time we go.
And since 2008, how many shipments have you made and what is the scope of the materials that you send over?
We've sent everything from a CAT scan machine down to basic everyday medications. Hard to say how much because we're shipping constantly, and then every year we're carrying a large amount over. When I'm over there, I try to identify simple needs and then specifically get equipment to that rather than just ship containers of things that are often useless. I see a lot of containers arrive over in the Congo just filled kind of haphazardly with a lot of goods, many of which are never used. I try to focus more on what the clinics we're working with or the hospitals we're working with, their specific needs, and then tailor it to that. And you have to realize that over there, often a hospital won't have running water, doesn't have a dependable electrical supply. So a lot of our equipment is not tailor-made to their needs. So sometimes you have to think out of the box. Yeah, you have to look to China or India for the kind of medical equipment they're making. You have to think of things like this year that we installed solar power at one of the hospitals. And then if it's 110 type electricity, it has to be on a step-down unit because the electricity over there is 210. But I try to go with very simple, very easy-to-repair equipment, very basic, very durable. I think I've learned a lot about tailoring more the equipment to the needs. I mean, I have people that want to give me things like high-tech cardiac monitors or dialysis machines, and you really have to think what will work over there. So I think some of the initial equipment we sent was not always tailored exactly to the needs. You have equipment failures, too, and it can be hard to repair over there. Try to address that with again, simple things that work, and often veterinary equipment. And that may sound cavalier to say use veterinary equipment with humans, but a lot of it is reusable, so sustainable. A lot of it's very durable. It's simple enough to work with, and that has met the bill of our needs several times. And I've been lucky to have some veterinarians that have donated equipment and that have advised me a lot on what to use.
Dr. Sylvia Esser Gleason with Project Congo here in Dayton, working to make things better in a faraway place. Thanks for speaking with us.
Well, thanks for having me, and I want people to keep the Congo in their heart because people are dying and suffering over there.
Dr. Sylvia, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Sylvia Esser Gleason with Project Congo. You can learn more about them at projectcongo.org. That's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.